الحمد لله وكفى والصلاة والسلام على عباده الذين اصطفى خصوصا على افضلهم وخاتم النبيين محمد الامين وعلى اله وصحبه اجمعين اما بعد فقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى كما ورد في سورة الاحزاب اعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم لقد كان لكم في رسول الله أسوة حسنة لمن كان يرجو الله واليوم الآخر وذكر الله كثيرا صدق الله العظيم رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي اللهم ربنا ألهمنا رشدنا وأعذنا من شرور أنفسنا اللهم ارنا الحق حقا وارزقنا اتباعه وارنا الباطل باطلا وارزقنا اجتنابه اللهم وفقنا ان نجاهد في سبيلك باموالنا وانفسنا اللهم ارزقنا شهادة في سبيلك امين يا رب العالمين Dear brothers and sisters and sons and daughters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As you know, now we have to discuss the most practical and most important question. How this system of caliphate can be established? In this connection, let me first of all quote a saying of Imam Malik rahimahullah. It has been reported to have said, لن يصلح آخر هذه الأمة إلا بما صلح به أولها. The last part of this Ummah will not be reformed. It will not be possible to reform the last part of the Ummah except on the same pattern, on the same lines, on the same methodology with which the first part of the Ummah was reformed. And actually these words essentially appear in the sermon of Hazrat Abu Bakr radiallahu ta'ala anhu, which he delivered when he nominated Hazrat Umar radiallahu ta'ala anhu as his successor. He delivered a khutbah, and in that khutbah these words appear, إِنَّ هَذَا الْأَمْرِ لَا يَسْلُهُ آخِرُهُ إِلَّا بِمَا صَلَحَ بِهِ أَوَّلُهُ. So actually this essence was taken by Imam Malik rahmatullahi alayhi from this saying, and then he used those words that I have already quoted. Now the hadith that I quoted in the very beginning of this series of lectures on Khilafah, Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, according to that hadith which is included in the Musnad of Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal rahimahullah, reported by Hazrat Numan ibn Bashir radiyallahu ta'ala anhu, according to this hadith, there are going to be 5 periods from the times of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam till the end of this world. After his own time, he said, there will be a period of Khilafah ala minhajin nubuwa. Then a period of Mulkan Azzam. Then a period of Mulkan Jabriyan. And lastly, again a period of Khilafah ala minhajin nubuwa. So now you join these two, the saying of Hazrat Abu Bakr of Imam Malik rahimahumullah and this hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The inevitable conclusion is that now the system of Khilafah can be established only by adopting the same methodology which was adopted by Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. There can be no two opinions about it. But let me explain this point logically also. We have seen that the system of caliphate is a whole politico-socio-economic system. And there is no place on earth where some politico-socio-economic system is not established already. So you have to uproot that existing system, and then only you can establish the alternate political socio-economic system of the caliphate. This means a total revolution is required. So we have to adopt a revolutionary ideology, methodology. And now we look to the effects of history. First of all, let us understand what is a revolution. What do you mean by a revolution? According to the modern way of thinking, human life is divided into two parts. The religious part of the life and the secular part of the life. And it is the axiom, the basic principle, universally accepted today, that regarding this religious side of the life, every individual is free, independent. But in the political, socio-economic, collective system, secular system of life, no reference will be made to any religion whatsoever. It's the right of the people to decide what to do and what not to do. The laws will be framed. That is the principle of human sovereignty and secularism. You can believe whatever you like, you are free. You worship anything you like, you are free. You may believe in one God, in 100 gods, in 1,000 gods, in no God. You can worship idols, you can worship sun, you can worship snakes, you can worship anything you like. You may worship the genital organs. There are, you know, in Hindus there are the sex. So you can worship anything. Go to temple, go to mosque, go to synagogues, go to churches, you are free. You can solemnize marriage as you like, you can celebrate birth as you like, you can dispose of the dead body as you like. You bury it, you burn it, you keep it for the birds to eat, you are free. So this is universally accepted truth, the principle. Every human being is free to adopt any religion. And this religion, as I enunciated, it consists of three parts: dogma, modes of worship, and some social customs. But the other part of the life, the political system, the social system, the economic system, well, here, no religion whatsoever. No reference to any divine laws or divine guidance. Here, people will decide the matters for themselves by majority vote, that's all. So actually, by revolution what is meant is some fundamental change in at least one of the aspects of the politico-socio-economic system. Change in dogmas, in aqidah, you don't call it a revolution. Let me give you an example. It so happened in the year 300 A.D. that the Roman Emperor Constantine, he accepted Christianity. Before that time, the Romans were persecuting the Christians, the followers of Hazrat Masih alayhi salatu wasalam. They were badly persecuted throughout the Roman Empire. But suddenly there was a change. The Roman Emperor, the Byzantine Emperor, Constantine, embraced and accepted, got converted to Christianity, and the whole empire got converted to Christianity. The biggest event of the history, one of the biggest events. But you never call it a revolution. Have you ever heard the term revolution with this incident? No. Because the change was on the religious plane. Only in that aspect of life which is religious. Dogma, that's all. But you call French Revolution a revolution. Why? There was a fundamental change in the political structure of the society. You call Bolshevik Revolution a revolution. Why? Because there was a fundamental change in the economic structure of the society. I think these examples bear it out very clearly. What we mean by revolution is some fundamental change in any of the three aspects of the collective system which today is thought to be secular side of human life, That is the political system, the economic system, or the social system. Now, second point. Have a bird's eye view of the whole human history. All the revolutions have been partial. The only total revolution, complete revolution, involving all the six aspects of the life, not only the dogma, iman, shirk change to tawheed, the modes of worship, salah, saum, hajj, zakah, social customs, nikah, burial, aqiqah, celebrating the birth, then the social system, all the norms, then the economic system, the whole structure changed. Political system, whole changed. Here I used to say that here you will have to find by a microscope anything which was not changed. Total change. French Revolution was a partial revolution, the change was only in the political structure. The aqidah was the same, the social norms were the same, social order was the same, everything the same. Economic order the same. In Bolshevik Revolution, only the economic structure was changed. Christians remained Christians as they were. So, my point number two is that there is only one example throughout human history of a total revolution, and that is the revolution of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And that is what Michael Hart said in his famous book, The 100. A selection and gradation of the 100 most influential persons of human history. He selected the 100 and then a gradation was made. And he puts Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam on top. Why? He himself says clearly, naturally I owe an explanation. Why I have put Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam on top of this list? And he says this is because he is the only person, note the word the only, there is no other example throughout the human history. He is the only person supremely successful on both the religious and secular planes. The same words he has used with which I have started my discussion. Religious side of life, secular side of life. There is only one person. All the other big personalities, either they are important in this field or in this field. Jesus Christ, Gautam Buddha, very important on the religious side. But on the secular side, could they establish any system, political system? Could they change the social order? No. Alexander the Great, Genghis Khan, Attila, very big conquerors. One going from the east to the west. Two, Attila and Genghis. And the other, coming from, you know, Greece to Bias, Punjab. But have they any achievement on the moral, ethical or spiritual level? Zero. Rather some minus value will have to be assigned. Only one assignment. And that is Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Most supremely successful person in both the fields. There is a third point. It's very exclusive example, solitary example, that a revolution accomplished in 20 years, number one, and number two, at all the stages and steps of the revolutionary process, the same person is leading. The same person was preaching in the streets of Makkah, and the same person was leading the armies at Badr and Uhud and Hunayn. You cannot have any example. For the French Revolution, Voltaire and Rousseau and so many writers, thinkers, they gave the ideology. But they had no part. They were not men of the field. They were only writers, thinkers, sitting on the desk, writing. They couldn't give the revolution a practical leadership. That is why French Revolution was very bloody. In the same way, Marx and Engels, thinkers, authors, Das Kapital, they brought and they wrote it. No doubt, a very influential book. They wrote it in Germany and staying in England. But the revolution, they couldn't bring about a revolution in any village even, but to speak of a country. The revolution took place in Russia. Struggle was by the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, and final leadership was of Lenin. There's no example in human history. Single person starting his mission. Single person. And within 20 years, accomplishing this miraculous feat of changing the whole political, socio, economic, as well as the religious order of a whole country, the Arabian Peninsula. What's the conclusion? If you want to understand what is a revolutionary methodology, what's the revolution process, the only source is the seerah of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. The life of Marx cannot give you any idea. Life of Voltaire or Rousseau cannot give you any light on this. Even of Lenin and Mao, they cannot give you light. Because the ideology was not produced by them. They didn't start the movement. They were the secondary actors on that drama. The only source, if you want really to know what a revolutionary process is, what are the prerequisites of a revolutionary process, what are the different stages of the revolutionary process, what are the conditions for changing from one stage to another stage of the revolutionary process, the only source, I'm using the same word as Michael Hart, the only source is the seerah and life of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now, two things have met here. The saying of Abu Bakr and the saying of Imam Malik. لَنْ يَصْلُحَ آخِرَ هَذِهِ الْأُمَّةِ إِلَّا بِمَا صَلَحَ بِهِ أَوَّلُهَا. You have to turn to the seerah of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, to the model of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And logically I have proved this revolution is the only total revolution, and you know it's the only example that a revolution was accomplished in the limited span of one human life. 23 years we call it. He started his mission, his dawah, in the year 610. And he died in the year 632. 22 years, according to the solar calendar. Starting from one person and accomplishing the whole and the most total, all-comprehensive, most profound revolution of the history of mankind. So we have to focus, you know, our microscope on the seerah. That is why today, you know, I recited the ayah from Surah Al-Ahzab. لَقَدْ كَانَ لَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةٌ حَسَنَةٌ لِمَنْ كَانَ يَرْجُ اللَّهَ وَالْيَوْمَ الْآخِرَ وَذَكَرَ اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا. You have a model in the person of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. We think only that he is a model regarding, you know, as a person. Yes, he is a model in his personal life, in his personal character, his behavior. He is a model for fathers. Because he was a father. He was father of Fatima. His model as a husband. His model in every respect. But the most important aspect of this model is the way he brought about this change, the most profound change, the most comprehensive, profound revolution of the history of mankind. And we must turn to his seerah to understand the process of Islamic revolution, or to understand how we can establish the system of Khilafah again on earth. Now, I have inferred six, or I'll add one, seven steps of revolutionary process from the seerah of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Why I have added one? Through six steps he accomplished the revolution in Arabian Peninsula. The seventh was the exploitation of that revolution, the globalization of that revolution, the internationalization of that revolution, The revolution in the Arabian Peninsula was complete by the 9th year after Hijrah, within 20 years. Rest of the 2 years were taken to initiate the process, which was then carried on afterwards by the caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, رضي الله تعالى عنهم. But the Prophet himself initiated the process of exporting this revolution beyond the boundaries of the Arabian Peninsula. So 6 + 1, 7 steps I have inferred from the seerah. But first of all, I propose to give you in brief these steps in generalized terms. I don't want to use the terms of the Quran and the Hadith. Why? There is a reason. Due to our very long process of downfall, the connotations and meanings of most of the Islamic terms have changed. In our minds, we have very limited concept of deen and very limited concept of the terminology of the deen. And when we use those terms, somehow or the other, the same limited concept comes to our mind. So first of all, I claim that I have inferred it from the seerah. And I infer it from the Quran and the Sunnah. But I am not going to use in the beginning the terminology of the Quran and the Sunnah. I want to give things basically in generalized terms. What are those steps? Step number one. To initiate a revolutionary process, there must be a revolutionary ideology. Every system of life is based on some ideology. Communism is based on Marxism. Democracy is based on the thought given by Voltaire and Rousseau. So every system has some ideological basis, and this revolutionary ideology must be such that it must cut at the roots of the existing system. Otherwise it will be a sermon. It will be a vase. It will not initiate the revolutionary process. You want to change the system. So the ideology must cut at the roots of the existing system. Number two, either the ideology should be new, or if it is an old ideology, it must be reinterpreted in the current idiom of the time and at the level of consciousness of that time. If you are using the same terminologies, the same level of consciousness as was before, the intelligentsia of your time won't be able to accept it. You have to use the current idiom, and you have to present that ideology at the intellectual level, at the level of consciousness of your time. Only then it will be able to catch the imagination of the intelligentsia, the intellectuals, otherwise not. So please enumerate. First step, there must be a revolutionary ideology which must cut at the very roots of the existing political, socio-economic system. Number two, it must be either a new ideology or if a old ideology reinterpreted in the current idiom at the intellectual level of that time. And then you have to propagate that ideology. And for propagation, you have to use all the means available. If you don't want to use the communication channels of your time, you won't be able to influence the society. You have to use all the channels, all the media, as much as you can avail of it. So this is the first step. What's the second step? Whosoever accepts that revolutionary ideology at its face value, as it is, and consciously, not emotionally only, consciously, understanding it, accepting it. Now you organize them into a party. Without organization, without a party, a revolution cannot be brought about. A mob can only do some disruptions and destructive work, can't bring about a change. For a change, you have to have a party. And this party also should fulfill two preconditions, two pre-qualifications. Number one, It must be as disciplined as the proverbial discipline of army. Because in the long run you have to confront the system. For that, the organization must not be loose. The discipline of an army. Well, what's the proverbial discipline of the army? Listen and obey. If in an army you question the command of your superior, well, first I must understand why you are giving me this order. Only then I'll comply. It's not an army then. The best example is in that poem, Charge of the Light Brigade. You must have read it, I think. I read it in my high school days. Beautiful poem. A command was given to the Light Brigade, charge! And every person in that brigade knew that someone has blundered. It's the wrong command. Cannons to right of them, cannons to left of them, cannons in front of them. Someone has blundered. But there's not to reason why, there's but to do and die. So into the valley of death roared the 600. This is the proverbial discipline of the army. Listen and obey. It's not for you to reason why. Your job is to do or die. So the discipline must be that of an army. Number two, the cadres in this revolutionary party should be new. And the status of every worker, every member should be determined by the depth of his commitment, the intensity of devotion and the amount of sacrifice he is putting in. There should be no reflection of any social gradations which were present in that society previously. Let me explain this point with an example. If even in the Communist Party of India, the Brahman was superior and the Shudra was inferior, it was not a revolutionary party at all. It could only qualify to be called a revolutionary party if the Shudra, if he was more committed, if his devotion was more than the Brahman, if his sacrifices were more than those of a Brahman, he should be at a higher level and the Brahman should be at the lower level. There should be no reflection of the pre-existing cadres, pre-existing gradations. We should have new cadres. And the position of every person must be determined by his depth of commitment, intensity of devotion, and amount of sacrifice that he is putting. Now what's the third step? You have to train the cadres, train the workers. Allama Iqbal has said very beautifully, Khaam hai jab tak tu hai mitti ka ek ambar tu, pukhta ho jaye tu hai shamshir bezinhar tu. You have to be mature. And that puchtari, that maturity of a revolutionary worker, that needs some training. And actually, a more beautiful couplet is from Akbar al-Ahbabi. Tu khaak mein mil aur aag mein jal, jab khisht bane tab kaam chale, ان خام دلوں کے عنصر پر بنیاد نہ رکھ تعمیر نہ کر. These people who are خام, immature, commitment, no commitment, just hobby, working just as a hobby, don't take any step forward unless you have trained cadres with you, determined people. So that is the third step, training of the workers, of the cadres. Now what are the aims and objects of the training of a revolutionary group? The first and the foremost is to maintain, rather increase the understanding of the revolutionary ideology. It shouldn't fade away in their minds, because that is the main source of their inspiration. That ideology should remain fresh. It has to be renewed time to time. Number two, when they should be trained to bear the hardships, because in a revolutionary struggle, You have to undergo hardship. It's not a bed of roses to change a system. And every system has vested interest. And the vested interest wants status quo. Because if you change the system, their interests are threatened. They have to resent and they have to resist. There's going to be conflict. And you will have to undergo hardships, bear hardships. And for that, you need to be trained. Then there should be the determination. It should be on the increase. That they are ready to give up everything they have, even their life, for the cause of that revolution. Then they should be accustomed to listening and obeying. It's not an easy job. Why should I obey him? He's also a human being. I'm not an employee. He doesn't pay me. Why should I obey him? You know, they should be accustomed. And it needs a lot of training to listen and obey. Hum bhi tasleem ki khu daalenge. Be-niyazi teri aadat hi sahi. The khu, the habit. Habit of listening to me. These are the four basic objectives of the training of every revolution. But if the system that you want to establish by that revolution has some moral, ethical and spiritual dimensions also, then you have to purify the souls of the workers beforehand. If their souls are not purified, how can they bring about a revolution by which a system of life having spiritual and ethical and moral dimensions can be established? So this is the additional one. The previous four, they are essential for every revolution. Whether it is communist revolution or any other revolution, only materialistic revolution, they are common. But additional fifth factor is that if the system, politico-socio-economic system that you want to establish has a moral, ethical and spiritual dimension, then you must purify the souls of the workers, cadres, who are working for the end of bringing about that revolution. Now we come to the fourth step. But please note here, this fourth step starts with the first step. These are two sets. One, two, three. And the fourth again starts from the very beginning. What is that? I label it as passive resistance. Because conflict must be there. And please mind it. These things should be very clear. Who starts the conflict? The revolutionaries. They say this system is wrong. The system was there. People had reconciled to it. Although it was exploitative. But you know, those who were exploited, they had reconciled to it. They were living with it. There was repression. But those who were repressed were accustomed to it. They had taken it as a fate. Now a person says, this is wrong. This order, this system is unjust. This is repressive. This is exploitative. This is discriminative. Who has started the controversy? It's the revolutionary force or revolutionary people who start the controversy. And the reaction is from the existing political, socio-economic system. And what's the reaction? First of all, they say, you have gone crazy. You are fools. You are fanatics. There's nothing wrong with our system. It's okay. It's working for the centuries. You have gone crazy. Verbal persecution starts the moment you challenge the validity of the system. Verbal persecution will start immediately. And if you are not disheartened, the revolutionaries continue their work. And the existing power basis, they are threatened, they feel, when our youth are listening to this new call, they are being possessed by this ideology. We are joining that camp day by day. And people who had suppressed up till now, now they have begun to understand that their rights were usurped. نظام کوہنا کے پاس بانو یہ معرض انقلاب میں ہے. گارڈ اپ یور رائٹس, ڈیفینڈ یور انٹرسٹ, بیٹ دم, کیپ دم ہنگری, پٹ دم ان جیل, پٹ دم ان چینز. دس از واٹ وی کال دی فزیکل پرسیکیوشن. بٹ دی فورتھ فیز اور دی فرسٹ فیز آف دس کانفلکٹ از دی ریولیوشنریز مسٹ ٹیک آل دی پرسیکیوشن وداؤٹ اینی ریٹیلیشن. They shouldn't become violent. If they become violent from the very beginning, when they are only a few, they are not strong enough. If they retaliate, if they become violent, they will be crushed like anything. But if they are taking the persecution without retaliation, there is a very important, profound result that the sympathies of the silent majority, they turn in favor of those revolutionaries. Why are they being beaten? Have they committed any theft? Have they committed any other crime? No. Only they say the system is not correct, the system is wrong. It is unjust, there should be justice. It is discriminative. The discrimination should come to an end. It is exploitative, the exploitation should be finished. This is the only crime for which they are being beaten. They are being hanged. They are being shot by firing squads. They are being pulled and they are made to rot in the jails. So the inevitable result is that the silent majority, although it is silent, it is not blind, it is not deaf, it is dumb, silent. Can't take the courage of challenging the people in power. They are silent, but they are not blind, they are seeing what is happening. They are not deaf, they are listening to what is the cries of those people who are being persecuted. They are coming and piercing their ears. Human nature is human nature. The inevitable result is with the sympathy, imperceptibly, the sympathy, wave of sympathy of the silent majority is moving in favor of the revolutionaries. Jo dilon ko fatha kar le wahi fateh hai zamana. Now, fifth step is, if the revolutionary party and its leadership feels now we are strong enough, now we can risk a head-on collision. We have enough number of cadres, trained cadres, who are ready to lay down their lives, ready to give everything they have. Their depth of commitment, their intensity of devotion, unquestionable. And enough number. Now, they challenge the system openly. And you know, every politico-socio-economic system is an organic whole, just like this body. If you hit here, the whole body feels the pain. There's a hadith to that effect. If you hit my head, or not only the head is feeling the pain, it's the whole body. You can challenge any system, any part, any aspect of the system. To give you an example, you know, for the non-violence and passive resistance, the non-violence of Gandhi. I don't want to give the examples from the Prophet. I told you. I want to make things intelligible in generalized terms and forms. Although I have published a statement of Mia Muhammad Shafi, the serial most journalist of Pakistan, Neem Shin, you know, he told me that Sarhadi Gandhi, Abdul Ghaffar Khan, said to him, that Gandhi said to him, to Abdul Ghaffar Khan, that I learned non-violence from Jesus and Muhammad, alayhi salatu wasalam wa sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. This is only to quote. But I am quoting here Gandhi. Non-violence. But when he decided to have an open confrontation with the British government, what did he do? Namak Banao Tehreek. Have you heard of it or not? Well, Paramatma, Samandar Paramatma ka hai. Paramatma ne isme namak banaya hua hai. Hum samandar ke paani se namak banayenge. We are not challenging anybody. We are not hurting anybody. This ocean belongs to the Creator, the Lord. And there is salt in the water of the ocean. We want to make salt out of it, that's all. But what did it mean? It challenged the whole taxation policy of the British India. There was excise duty. You were challenging the excise duty. What happened? Now they were beaten. Lathi charged. Everything happened then. So this is the point which I am making. When the leadership of the revolutionary party feels we are strong enough in number, in training, in determination, in devotion, people won't turn their backs, they won't run away. They will take the bullets on their chests and the lathis on their heads. They are ready to sacrifice their lives. Now you challenge the system and you can challenge it in any way you like. One of the very famous things is stop paying taxes, non-cooperation. The system is wrong. We won't pay taxes. What will happen? The same thing will happen. Lathi charge. Put them to jails. Arrest them. So this is, in any way you can challenge the system, this is the fifth step. And I have labeled it as active resistance. First was passive resistance. Why was it resistance? Because you are standing where you are. The total persecution is not compelling you to give away your revolutionary ideology. You are standing firm. This is resistance. But you are not retaliating. It is passive. But now you are challenging. You are advancing. So it is the active resistance. And the final inevitable sixth step is, then there will be and there is going to be an armed conflict. What happened in France? What happened in Russia? What happened in China? Everywhere. The system has to defend itself. Tsar of Russia couldn't take it lying down. His empire being threatened. What for? Had he the armies? Then there has to be an armed conflict. And now if the revolutionaries have passed the whole process, fulfilling the conditions, consolidating their position on every step, they have not hastily gone without preparation, without training. If they have committed the mistake of making haste, they will be exterminated, eliminated, crushed, finished. And if they had fulfilled the conditions of every step and they had gradually, step by step, progressed, then they will succeed. In Urdu you have the saying, Ya Takht Ya Takhta. Now there can be no third alternative. Either the revolution succeeds, now the revolutionaries have the reins of power, they establish their system, or they are crushed, they are eliminated, exterminated, annihilated. No third alternative. These are the six steps. I have inferred them exclusively, totally, from the seerah of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But I have given these steps to you in generalized terms, so that you accept this at the face value, at the face value of its logic. The sequence that it has, the logical sequence. And then the seventh step is there. And let me say here, the seventh step of exporting that revolution. Revolution is always brought about in some one country to begin with. You cannot have a global revolution at once. Impossible. even if you aspire for it, even if you want it. But the only possible methodology is, the only possible procedure is that you must focus all your strength on some one point. Don't dissipate and disseminate your energy. I'll, you know, prove all these points from the seerah later on, tomorrow inshallah. Tomorrow actually, 2 hours that we are going to take, is going to be an analysis of the seerah. It's going to be the philosophy of seerah. Seerah is something else and philosophy of seerah is something else. History is something else and philosophy of history is something else. So I will give you an analysis. And here I was only discussing, every true revolution must be exported. No true revolution can remain confined and limited to any geographical or national boundary. And this is the litmus test of the true revolution. You may call a change a revolution, but if it doesn't go out of the national boundaries, it's not a revolution. That is why I said that Iranian revolution is not a true revolution. It appears to be a revolution. It's not a true revolution. It couldn't be exported. Nationalism was inbuilt in it from the very beginning. You know the same charge which the Chinese, they blamed the Russians, that they have changed from Marxism to Russian nationalism. Nationalism is something else. They said that these Russians are revisionists, they have changed the original Marxist philosophy. So actually, but Russian revolution was a revolution in the beginning. Later on it took the national, you know, tones. But Iranian revolution, it couldn't be exported. And it has already lost its vigor, the original vigor. It's now diminishing day by day. So that I will, inshallah, if we can spare some time tomorrow, I'll speak about that also. But here, please note one point. It's the litmus test of a true revolution that it has to go beyond the national or geographical or, you know, national boundaries. Just as we have French Revolution brought about in France, spread to most of the whole of the world. Bolshevik Revolution brought about in Russia, traveled to Latin America. Mohammedan Revolution, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, brought about in Arabian Peninsula, spread east, west, north, within 24 years, from where to where, from Oxus to Atlantic. Now, because we have about 8 minutes at our disposal, let me begin with, you know, because tomorrow each and every minute will be very precious for us. Now we come to the analysis of the seerah of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. What is the revolutionary ideology of the revolution of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam? In one word, it is Tawheed. And I have expressed the first and most important corollary of Tawheed is sovereignty is for Allah. Negation of human sovereignty. The second, everything belongs to Allah. Negation of human ownership. Third, all humans equal. Negation of all discrimination. Tawheed is not only an aqeedah, it's the most potent, most powerful revolutionary ideology. And let me quote here, I apologize to Arab brethren, but maybe they also, if they can listen to the translation, you know, they may enjoy it. Iqbal says, Zinda quwwat thi zamane mein ye tawheed kabhi, aur ab kya hai faqat ek masala hai ilm-e-kalam. It's an issue of theology. Tawheed. Dogma. Aqeedah. Do you know that this word aqeedah doesn't appear in Quran, in Hadith? The basic terminology is iman. I have devoted 6 hours here to discuss what is iman. And all iman embodied in one word, tawheed. آمنتُ بِاللَّهِ كَمَا هُوَ بِأَسْمَائِهِ وَصِفَاتِهِ وَقَبِيْتُ جَمِيعَ أَحْكَامِهِ إِقْرَارٌ بِاللِّسَانِ وَتَصْدِيقٌ بِالْقَلْبِ. So that was the, and that will remain the revolutionary ideology to implement Khilafah. What is Khilafah? Vicedency of Muslims. Negating the sovereignty, concept of human sovereignty. Not only of individuals, but also of the nation, but also of the whole of humanity. Sovereignty belongs to Allah. I have detailed discussions about these things already done. And number two, how did he propagate his revolutionary ideology? He used all the methods, all the means which were available in that society. Personal contact, first of all. Person to person. Al-Aqrab fal-Aqrab. His own wife, his most close friend, his adopted son, who was previously a slave, his first cousin, that is Hazrat Khadija, Hazrat Abu Bakr, Hazrat Zaid, Hazrat Ali, radiyallahu ta'ala anhum. 1 + 4, they were 5. Then the command from Allah came, وَأَنْزِرْ عَشِيرَتَكَ الْأَقْرَبِينَ. He called his whole family, Banu Hashim, invited them to meals. He offered them meal. And then he stood up to address. But there was hooting. There was Abu Lahab also. He didn't let anybody listen anything. The attempt went in vain. He couldn't even address. Then for the second time, he again invited. Again people took their meals. And then they were, I suppose, ashamed. We have taken meals twice now. Now we should listen to him. And then he gave the khutbah. إِنَّ الرَّائِدَ لَا يَكْسِبُ أَهْلَهُ وَاللَّهِ لَوْ كَذَبْتُ النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا مَا كَذَبْتُكُمْ وَلَوْ غَرَرْتُ النَّاسَ جَمِيعًا مَا غَرَرْتُكُمْ وَاللَّهِ الَّذِي لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوْ إِنِّي لَرَسُولُ اللَّهِ إِلَيْكُمْ خَاصَّةً وَإِلَى النَّاسِ كَافَّةً وَاللَّهِ لَتَمُوتُنَّ كَمَا تَنَامُونَ ثُمَّ لَتُبْعَثُنَّ كَمَا تَسْتَيْقِظُونَ ثُمَّ لَتُحْسَبُنَّ بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ ثُمَّ لَتُجْزَبُنَّ بِالْإِحْسَانِ إِحْسَانًا وَبِسُوءِ سُوءًا وَإِنَّهَا لَجَنَّةٌ أَبَدًا وَلَنَارٌ أَبَدًا. I won't translate. I have a booklet, Da'wat ilallah. This whole text is there, the translation in Urdu. And the booklet is also in English. The whole text with English translation is also there. I only want to make the point that any available means to propagate the ideology, he adopted. Then came the commandment, Fasda bima tumar. Now say it loudly. And then he climbed, you know, that hillock of Safa. And he cried, the same cry, which was the custom of this society. Wa sabaha! It was the custom. If somebody had the news that some tribe is going to attack our tribe, what did he do? The custom was, he became naked, put off all the clothes, and stood at some high place so that people can see. He was called An-Nazirul Uryan, the naked warner. Everybody could see there's a person naked, stark naked, standing on some height. So there is some bad news, some very important news. So people ran to him from all the directions. And he cried, Wa sabaha, the bad morning that is coming. Because generally the tribal raids were committed in the small hours of the morning. He did the same, except he couldn't be naked. I want to give you a point. All the means of communication you can adopt, but you have to see If something is haram, you can't adopt it. If something is immoral, you can't adopt it. But all the other means you have to adopt. Then he did street preaching also, going from door to door in the streets. So all these things that were available for the propagation of his ideology of Tawheed, قُلُوا لَا إِلَٰهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ, that was the da'wah. يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسِ قُلُوا لَا إِلَٰهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ, that is the basic ideology, the revolutionary ideology of the revolution of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And I have given you the couplet from Iqbal, زندہ قوت تھی زمانے میں یہ توحید کبھی اور اب کیا ہے فقط ایک مسئلہ ہے علم کلام. So this is going to be, and you have to present now this principle of توحید and its social corollaries, where it cuts at the roots of the existing politico-socio-economic system in the current idiom and at the intellectual level of your time. If you can't do it, you can't even initiate a truly Islamic revolutionary process. أقول قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي ولكم ولسائر المسلمين والمسلمات. Tomorrow we shall be beginning with the organization. What was the pattern of organization? Of the Hezbollah, of the party, Islamic Revolutionary Party, which was established and founded by Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.